99%ers. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the story of the week, of course, is the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, raising rates again. Now the benchmark rate at roughly 2% and going higher. They say there will be at least two more rate hikes, which will raise the benchmark rate, called the federal funds rate, to 2.5% by year end. And the Fed this week said, well, we're going to have at least three more coming next week. I mean, next year, 2019. Well, as I've been saying, and we'll reiterate here, I don't believe the Fed can raise its interest rates much above 2.5%, maybe 2.75 at the very most, without provoking a credit crunch. This means that 2.5%, 2.75 of the federal funds rate is the upper limit, after which you're going to get a major financial contraction, which will set off the next recession in 2019 sometime. Well, that's been my view. And, you know, that 2.5, 2.75 number is about half of what it was in 2007-08, when the Fed raised the same interest rate to 5.25%, which tripped the economy at the time, which was financially very fragile, tripped it into recession. Big one, right? And of course, the financial system cracked, and that made it even worse. Okay, so we'll see. This is interesting. The Fed thinks the U.S. economy is really hot and booming. Well, prices are going up. You all know that, don't you? Sure, you feel that. Prices are going up. They think that's an indication that the economy is booming. Well, it's really an indication of rising oil prices on the one hand, which have a repercussion throughout the economy, and it's a result of companies that haven't been able to raise prices, now thinking in anticipation of the economy growing, they start raising prices everywhere. Yeah, we know prices are going up for everything. Well, you know, that doesn't mean that the economy is overheated. It just means that businesses are trying to take advantage of what they think will happen by raising prices. Well, we're going to see. We're going to see what happens here. And we'll come back to this question of the Federal Reserve, the central banks raising interest rates and precipitating another recession, which leads to the whole question, you know, why should an institution like the Fed, Federal Reserve, central bank, have so much power and not be democratically elected? Yes, the Fed, of course, central banks are shielded from public pressure, but they're not so shielded from banking pressure. Yeah, the banks still cleverly manipulate the Fed, particularly the New York Fed district, and use it to their advantage. Well, that's a theme of my most recently produced book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes. at the end of which the book I lay out what should be done. And what should be done is to democratize the central bank, make it responsive to public interests, not just to the bankers. Well, if we have time at the end of the show, I'll share with you some of the conclusions and recommendations I make in my book, excuse me, to do just that. But before we get back to the Fed, and by the way, this week as well, the European Central Bank made a momentous decision. The European Central Bank said they weren't going to start raising rates themselves for another year. You see, there's real pressure for them to do so. If the Fed is raising rates and the ECB, European Central Bank, is not, then you have a big gap between interest rates, which is growing between Europe and the US. And the bigger the gap, the more money capital in Europe flows out of Europe to the US in search of the higher rates. And in other words, the ECB has a contradiction. If they don't raise their rates and the US does, well, all the money they've been pumping into their economy through their own quantitative easing free money policy now for several years, right? A lot of that money is going to flow out of Europe, won't benefit Europe, and flow into US markets, including financial markets like stocks and bonds and so forth. So the ECB and all other central banks are forced to follow the Fed globally. That's one way that the U.S. elite, economic elites, financial elites control the global economy. There's other ways. I've been talking about that as well here. We can see it with the emerging markets, right? If you control the global trading currency like the dollar is, you can control those economies and influence them, bring them down if you have to. Control of the dollar is the dominant currency, is a great imperialist economic weapon. Other imperialist economic weapons include the control of what the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and World Bank do. The U.S. really has veto power over those institutions as they were set up back in 1944. And, of course, now the influence over global interest rates is another weapon, economic weapon, that the U.S. has. Well, we'll return to this momentous week of decisions by the U.S. and the European Central Bank and what it all means here for the economy of Europe, which is not looking very good, and, of course, the economy in the U.S. Lagged down the road next year. But first, let's do a review of some past stories. There's some interesting reports that have come out in the past week that throw further light on some of the shows and the themes of the shows here in recent weeks. You know, a week or so ago, I did a show on what's called the precariat job problem. You know, precariat means precarious jobs, a play on the term proletariat, you know, precariat. All those workers in the U.S. whose employment is precarious, in other words, there's not a solid, firm relationship to their employer. They're kind of employed as the employer needs them. And the employer can get rid of them fairly easy. Temp jobs, right? Independent contract jobs, alternative work relationships, gig jobs, and so forth. Well, I've been saying that this has been a problem. In fact, I've been writing about this back in as early as 2006 in my book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush. I had a chapter called Welcome to the New World Work Order, and I talked about the rise of contingent jobs. You see, labor markets have been radically revised by businesses and by capitalists in the U.S. For decades now, starting with Reagan. And one of the restructurings of the labor markets in the United States has included the rise of what's called contingent jobs, workers who have only a contingent, weak relationship to their employers. Once again, these may be involuntary part-time jobs, temp jobs, and so forth, contract jobs, on-call jobs, and now we have gig jobs. And I've been saying this has been a significant development in the labor markets of the United States. And, by the way, in Europe and Japan as well. This is an advanced capitalist evolution, markets evolution, not just the United States. And I identified 30, 40 million people more than a decade ago in the U.S. who were in this contingent relationship based upon independent one-off studies that were done by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the 90s and early 2000s. And then when the problem got big, they stopped doing these studies, you see. And there were lowballing the amounts in these studies, and I critiqued these studies at the time in 2006 in that book, and argued the number was actually a lot larger and the problem was more significant than it was. Well, the last study was in 2006 by the government, and now they finally did another one in 2017-18 here. Not they, meaning the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they came out with a super lowball estimate. And I critiqued that estimate, and pointed out, in fact, you can read my critique if you haven't, a print version on my blog, jackrasmus.com. It's a few entries down. What was wrong with the Bureau of Labor Statistics study? Well, one thing that was really wrong with it was they admitted they didn't include any gig work. And the second major problem was they only estimated the precariat based upon people who had precarious jobs as their primary form of employment. Well, we know people who are in temp jobs and who are in involuntary part-time jobs and in gig jobs have multiple jobs to try to make ends meet, or their gig job may be a secondary job, you see. Well, the government excluded all those. Only if it was your primary job was it estimated. And the BLS study, of course, came to the conclusion that there really wasn't much change in 12 years between their 2005 study and their current 2017 study in these precarious jobs. About 10% of the workforce they estimated back then in 2005 were precarious alternative work relationships, contingent jobs. And, today it's really about the same. In fact, a little bit less. That was the conclusion of the BLS. So it's not really a problem. Well, they kept making the same errors that they made in the past in their estimate, and even then some additional errors. They didn't include, for example, as I said, all the gig jobs. But 69% of all Uber's 800,000 workers, yes, 800,000 are Uber drivers, and 69% of those drive as a second job. So they weren't included at all. In fact, as I said, none of the Uber employees were counted in the BLS survey. But the big problem is the BLS only measures primary jobs, right? Also a problem with the BLS is that their numbers are based upon a statistical manipulation of the ratio of these precarious alternative work to total employed in the labor force. It's a ratio. In other words, they estimate a ratio, and from there, they extrapolate on the number of those who are in precarious jobs. But as the labor force rises, the denominator of this ratio, which is alternative work, precarious relationships, actually goes down. Right? So you're really underestimating the total number by using a ratio, not an actual number. Well, you know, this is very typical of BLS and government statistics. They aren't actual numbers. They are statistics from which the actual numbers are estimated. You know, they're not raw data. Statistics are derivative creations of the raw data. So it matters what methodology you're using to come up with your statistical estimation. And here in the BLS study, we've got this ratio approach, you know, which grossly underestimates the number of precarious contingent jobs, because if the labor force is growing, the number of precarious jobs is actually going to go down. And of course, we have a lot of hiring of precarious part-time jobs and temporary jobs and so forth in recent years and right now, going on for several years now. So the growth of the number of precariat actually lowers the number that the BLS uses to estimate the precariat workforce. Also, others have pointed out there's probably a sampling bias here in the BLS study. Another private study was done by Princeton University professors a couple years ago, Katz and Kruger. They used a different approach. They has the same questions. They use the same questions as the BLS, or I could say the BLS then adopted the same questions that Katz and Kruger used. But the BLS study was done by a phone survey, whereas Katz and Kruger did an internet survey. Well, if you do an internet survey, you're going to get more people responding. You're going to get a better sample, as opposed to a phone survey that is only done during the day. And you're going to miss a lot of people who are working during the day. Okay, a phone survey, which is what the BLS does to estimate employment every month, gives you a bias. And I talked about that bias last week, and in my piece on my blog, jackerasmus.com, I talk about, explain how the phone survey just doesn't pick up a lot of groups like youth working in the underground economy in the inner cities and itinerant workers and undocumented and so forth, right? Doesn't pick them up very well. Well, you know, a study just came out, contrary to the BLS, here reported today in the Wall Street Journal, actually it was the June 13th Wall Street Journal, page 21, check it out, which criticizes the BLS survey. All right, this was a totally different survey, done looking at 1099 forms, IRS 1099 miscellaneous income forms. This is what will show, you know, contract labor, 1099. W-2 forms data will show people who are, you know, employed in a non-contingent relationship to their employer, but those who are contingent have to file their taxes using 1099 miscellaneous forms, right? Well, you know, this study here called the Upwork study shows 36% of the labor force is contract or free or doing contract or freelance work. Well, 36%, about a third of what, 160 million people in the labor force? Well, figure that out, you know. You're looking at somewhere between 50 and 60 million people now are precariat. That may be first or second jobs, but they're doing precariat work. So the study, you know, shows that 1099 miscellaneous jobs increased 22% between 2010 and 14. Oh, they're not even picking up 15, 16, 17. The trend probably is even higher than 22% increase in 1099 filings, whereas W-2 filings declined by 3.5% between 2010 and 14. Well, that gap between them really shows a significant growth in precariat jobs. And it doesn't, as I said, even include the last 3 years. Well, you know, the study pretty much critiques, as I've been critiquing, the BLS methodology for estimating the growth of the precariat workforce in the U.S. And why is it important? Because precariat jobs are not only lacking in any kind of job security, precariat jobs are typically paid far less than full-time, traditional, non-contingent work relations and jobs, right? Significantly less, 60-70%. And, you know, the precarious jobs have no benefits. Well, if American business is shifting to precariat employment of various kinds, of which gig is only a part of it, you see. Don't confuse gig economy with precariat. Yes, precariat includes gig work because it is not a traditional work for employers. You can't be guaranteed so many hours per work. Gig is part of it, but precariat is much bigger than that. You know, it's involuntary part-time, it's temp. By the way, another problem with the BLS study is that it only measures temp workers who are provided through temporary work agencies to employers. Well, a lot of temporary workers aren't hired through work agencies, you see. Well, look at the auto industry. Huge numbers in the last decade or so of people working in auto are temp workers. They're precariat. Well, they weren't hired through agencies. They were direct hired. That's one of the problems I've always said with BLS studies. You know, they only look at agency temps. They don't look at direct hired temps. Okay. So, that's a follow-up to that session we had a week or so ago on the precariat. You know, unfortunately, there's still people on the left who believe unquestioningly government labor statistics. It doesn't mean, I'm not arguing that, there's a big conspiracy there by the government. But I am arguing that the methodologies they use are purposely pretty conservative oftentimes when they want to lowball a number which has political ramifications. Okay. That's the precariat follow-up. Well, another interesting report came out this past week dealing with Trump tax cuts and corporate shuffling of profits to tax havens offshore. A study done by European professors and a professor Zuckman at UC Berkeley and University of Copenhagen professors here, a study released by UC Berkeley and University of Copenhagen, shows that U.S. multinational corporations offshore shelter 40% of their offshore profits to tax havens. Well, these tax havens, you know, are largely in places, like Ireland and Luxembourg and to some extent, Switzerland and Netherlands, so forth, right? And then, of course, these island and small principalities that are nations, like the Isle of Man in Europe, there's a favorite place for sheltering profits. Liechtenstein, tucked up there in the Alps is another one. 40% of U.S. multinational corporate profits offshore are sheltered in tax havens. And by the way, profits that are earned in the U.S. from U.S. business activity through intra-corporate pricing shifts are really profits earned here are shifted to their offshore operations and then shifted into tax havens, you see. Okay. Well, how much? How much of this 40% has been? Well, the UE, European Union, has estimated it's reduced their tax collections by 20% as a result. $200 billion a year. $200 billion a year. The OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Research Arm, over there, kind of like the Commerce Department research here, estimates $100 billion to $240 billion reduction in tax revenues occur because of this funneling of offshore profits by U.S. multinationals and other multinationals into tax havens in Europe. Well, this has implications for the Trump tax cuts, you see. Trump estimated that $300 billion a year in U.S. offshore profits were not being brought back to the U.S. Well, there's an accumulation of somewhere between $2.5 trillion to $4 trillion that I've been pointing out. That's $300 billion a year. And Trump claimed that his tax cuts would reduce this $300 billion a year to only $65 billion a year. Well, this study, what this study really means is that, you know, all this stuff is sheltered. If it's sheltered offshore, it's not coming back. You know, why should they bring it back and pay some taxes on it here when they can keep it offshore and sheltered? Okay, so that interesting study here on tax havens, right? Well, we have been talking as well in recent weeks about stock buybacks and how the Trump tax cuts are stimulating stock buybacks. And that means, of course, that you give these companies big tax cuts. They're not going to necessarily invest it in real production in the U.S. that would create real jobs. If they're taking the tax windfall and they're using it to purchase their stock, in other words, they're spending the money on stock purchases to drive up the demand for the stock and thereby drive up the price of U.S. stock. One of the reasons why the U.S. stock market just won't go down, you see, there's a lot of stock buybacks going on for the past year in anticipation of the tax cuts. And right now, since the Trump tax cuts were implemented this past January. Well, this recent report this week, interesting. It shows that corporate CEOs and senior managers have been selling their stock feverishly as their buybacks have been driving up the price. Well, that's illegal. That's called insider trading. But 385 corporations, a survey just done, 385 corporations who announced buybacks last year and in the first quarter of this year. Insider, in other words, CEO and senior managers with a lot of stock, selling of their stock has doubled. And not only has the sales doubled, but the amount of the sales has gone up fivefold. Daily insider sales, stock sales, averaged $100,000 before the stock buybacks and Trump tax cuts announced. Now it are running at $500,000 per sale on average. So the amount of sales are doubled, and the volume of the sales on average has gone up fivefold. Well, just as I predicted, a lot of this money from Trump Trump tax cuts is going to go to buybacks. Stock buybacks and dividend payouts, and to finance mergers and acquisitions, which are booming now, booming because of this big tax, Trump tax windfall. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, that sort of confirms what I've been saying for some time, what's going to happen. Another report of interest here is Bitcoin. If you remember earlier in the year, I had some shows on Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. And I argued that, oh, look, Bitcoin is just a speculative bubble. Bitcoin clearly is a manipulated financial asset. It's like a commodities future asset. You know, it's not really alternative currency. It's like gold futures, you know, and it's a pure speculative play. And when you have pure speculative plays that are unregulated markets, and the players can hide their profits from the tax man, which was the case of Bitcoin and all cryptos last year, 2017, well, then you're going to get this massive manipulation of markets to drive up the price. Well, a study just came out, says that's exactly what happened last year. A study by whom? Well, this guy, John Griffin, a finance professor at Texas, came out and revealed that this is what's really going on. Did a scientific study. He's a whistleblower, by the way, who also revealed in 2016 how the VIX, it's called the VIX financial indicator for stock price volatility, was manipulated. You know, a lot of derivatives were being purchased based upon the VIX. And the VIX, of course, was a derivative kind of investment play as well. Capitalists create all these derivatives and just buy and sell them based upon, you know, price changes and rises and collapses and so forth. You know, it's no different than going to Las Vegas and, you know, playing one of the, you know, the crap tables or playing roulette or anything like that, you know, baccarat. It's the same thing. It's just speculative investing based upon price changes. It's betting. It's betting. It's a casino. Derivatives are a casino, right? Well, this guy Griffin revealed, you know, last year that this VIX thing was a pure speculative play, and he's correct in that. But he also now comes out and blows the whistle on financial fraud with cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Yeah. What he did was point to this Bitcoin exchange in Asia called Bitfinex. Bitfinex, you know, and I've always said that, you know, a lot of this speculation is coming out of Asia. In fact, you know, Bitcoin was kind of created by an Asian exchange called Mt. Gox. And Mt. Gox, of course, was caught early in the history of Bitcoin manipulating the price. Well, Bitfinex now, you know, a cousin to Mt. Gox, has been revealed as doing the same thing last year. In fact, the study by Griffin alleges that one half of all the Bitcoin price appreciation last year, 2017, was the result of manipulation by the Bitfinex Bitcoin exchange. Well, I said in December, you know, it's going to collapse. And of course it did. Well, why did Bitcoin and cryptos collapse? Bitcoin is down 65% off of its highs last year. Well, why? Well, because, as I just said, you know, when you don't have any kind of regulation, and the tax man is not coming for your profits from the manipulation, then you get all this speculation. And I predicted late last year that, the tax man is going to come and the government is going to start regulating cryptos. And that's actually what began to occur. And once that began to occur, of course, cryptos and Bitcoin prices, the bubble collapsed. Right. Interesting. Also, a headline here today that Steve Bannon is now jumping on the Bitcoin bandwagon. Okay, you know, all these right wingers who complain about the system are now going to get rich from the system, you know. It's kind of like these bling-bling hip-hop guys, you know, whose music, you know, really tries to paint them as street folks, you know, out there struggling with all the other folks on the street. But then they go home to their big mansions in Beverly Hills, right? And all their bling bling, you know. Well, you know, Bannon and the right wingers are no different. You know, it's just Bitcoin bling bling. Okay. Another important, boy, there's a lot of these follow-up stories here last week. Another important story here is Epic Systems that I did. What was Epic Systems? Well, Epic Systems versus Lewis was the Supreme Court of the United States decision that was momentous for workers in this country, because it said that workers could be forced into arbitration by their employers and could not collectively join to file class action suits against their employers. In other words, you had to do it one by one. You couldn't engage in collective action. This has more to do with non-unionized workers, you know. At least there was some legal way of collective action. Well, collective activity was guaranteed under the 1936 Wagner Act, established the right for workers not only to form unions, but to engage in any kind of collective mutual benefit action. This was the basis of, you know, class action suits dealing with wage theft by fast food companies and so forth. Well, the employers have been for years now, several years, checking this class action by forcing workers to sign what's called mandatory arbitration agreements. And today, 54% of all corporations have mandatory arbitration agreements. Well, the Supreme Court decision gave that its blessing and said, yeah, it's okay. You can force your employers into mandatory individual arbitration with the employer. You know, yeah, you're going to go up against employer lawyers, you know, even if you get your own. They'll just drag it out and bleed you to death. And no attorney here for individual workers is going to take a case against a big corporation because it's they'll just drag you on for 10 years and you'll get nothing. The attorney will get nothing and the worker will get nothing. Well, that's what mandatory arbitration is all about. Another problem is a growing use of non-compete clauses for workers. 37% of all workers now have non-compete clauses. These are things you got to sign when you take a job, you know, a mandatory arbitration agreement, a non-compete clause, and so forth. Well, you know, employers say, well, we need non-compete clauses here because you're going to take company secrets with you if you go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Why do fast food chains, need their minimum wage workers to sign non-compete clauses? Is there some secret about the barbecue sauce in your burger? All right, are you going to take if you leave McDonald's and go to Wendy's? I mean, what the hell's going on? Non-compete clause. This is just a way of discouraging and tying up workers from taking any kind of action in defense of their interests. Well, this Epic Systems versus Lewis, important decision by the Supreme Court has come down. Big blow to workers and labor in this country, especially those who don't have a union. And now it's been revealed that, you know, 54% of corporations and mandatory arbitration, and even fast food companies are requiring non-compete clauses now at 37%. Okay. All right. Another announcement that just came out today, in fact, was Trump is moving forward with his $50 billion of tariffs on imported China goods. He announced that back in April when he threw down the gauntlet to China to force them to the bargaining table to negotiate. And negotiations have been going on. The $50 billion is based upon a list of Chinese exports to the U.S. on which Trump has threatened to raise 25% tariffs on this range of goods, right? Well, he just announced that he's going to move forward to implement these tariffs. Well, okay, you know, he's got a final list that he's announcing, $50 billion. But that doesn't mean that the tariffs are going to take effect. In fact, in a press conference, his press secretary Huckabee, Sandra Huckabee, when questioned, refused to say when the tariffs would actually take effect. This is all bargaining. This is all the attempt by Trump to gain some leverage in bargaining with the Chinese. And that's what his tariff policy, trade policy, is all about. We're just in the phase where he's identifying threats of what he may do. And that's to give him more bargaining leverage when his negotiators sit down with the Chinese, which they've been doing here. And, of course, the same thing with the Canadians and the Mexicans and the European Union now. This is all tit-for-tat threats. It's not a trade war yet. I don't believe it will be a trade war with Europe and NAFTA. I believe this is just the typical way that Trump negotiates, takes an extreme, outrageous position and demands to shake up his opponents, to get them to the table. And, you know, when he gets them to the table, then he negotiates based on his agenda. And he's in the driver's seat. This is the way he did his negotiations as a commercial property speculator, you know, hardball. But then, you know, he backs off and he accepts something. I think he's going to accept something with NAFTA, but he just doesn't want it now. He wants the deal right before the November elections, or he wants the deal in his back pocket if Mueller comes out with his indictment. You see, because the deal allows him to agitate and mobilize his domestic U.S. political base. And that's what he's in the process of doing, you see. And that's what a lot of all these outrageous statements on trade are for. They're for public consumption. You know, they almost had an agreement with Mexico and they meeting U.S. negotiators with Mexico and Canada. A couple of weeks ago, but then Trump stepped in and blew it up on purpose. He doesn't want an agreement yet. The timing is too early. He'll agree, you know, because he just wants something, and he's going to blow it all out of proportion, lie, exaggerate that it means more than it really does. Well, you know, Mexico and Canada, you know, are engaging in this response. You know, I think they really know where this is really going. I mean, look, Mexico counter tariffs announced, not implemented, announced, you know, a mere $3 billion of U.S. goods, right? Tariffs on U.S. goods into Mexico, $3 billion. That's token. That's nothing. The EU, same thing, $3 billion. That's nothing. You know, this is just a tit for tat, you know, my daddy can beat up your daddy kind of stuff going on between these different parts, right? It's interesting that China has offered the U.S. that it will buy $70 billion of more U.S. agriculture and energy products if the U.S. does not implement its $50 billion of tariffs. Well, the Chinese also said, you know, we'll do tit for tat too, you know. I mean, if we have to do a stick, you don't like our 70 billion carrot, if you don't like our stick, well, you know, what we'll do is implement 50 billion tariffs on U.S. Exports to China, particularly agriculture exports. China's the biggest by far purchaser of U.S. sorghum, very important, biggest agricultural product now coming out of the U.S. Midwest. This is all about gaining leverage for negotiations. You know, when Trump threatens steel and aluminum tariffs on Europe to get leverage, well, you know, we don't get that much steel and aluminum from Europe, some from Germany steel, but that's about it. You know, Europe's not a big problem with steel and aluminum imports. Most of our aluminum imports come from Canada. Yeah, Canada provides like 40, 50% of U.S. aluminum imports. Okay, so the point here about this announcement with China and the list of China tariffs this past week is it's still maneuvering by the parties. It's not a trade war yet. It's not a trade war even with China. Although, you know, we see that the U.S. intelligence and Pentagon, which is one of the interest groups on the U.S. trade negotiating team, is trying to reassert itself. As I've said and written in articles, you got three groups here in the U.S. trade negotiations, right? You got Trump, who wants to show something to his political base, particularly China buying more U.S. goods. That's why China said we'll buy $70 billion more a year, right? That's a play directly to Trump. And then you have the bankers and multinational corporations led by Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary. Well, China has given concessions there already in negotiations. They're saying to bankers and multinationals, look, you can now have majority ownership of companies in China you may purchase, 51%. Before that, U.S. companies could only have 49%. And China's even threw out a bigger plum saying, you can buy the whole company, maybe. Let's see how negotiations go. Well, that's exactly what the U.S. bankers and multinational corporations really want. They want more access to Chinese markets. Trump wants to show more purchase of U.S. goods. Well, you got this third element, which is the Pentagon and intelligence agencies in the U.S. They're involved in negotiations, too. What they really want is somehow to stop China tech transfer from U.S. corporations, you see. They're really worried about next-generation technologies like 5G, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, because this has big military implications. The Chinese may be able to leapfrog over the U.S. 13 aircraft carriers with this new cyber capabilities, and they want to stop China from stealing it from U.S. corporations, right? Who are the players there? Robert Lighthizer, this nutcase called Peter Navarro, who's been sidelined from the negotiating team. But we've seen this CIA group, CIA Pentagon, trying to reassert its role through Congress, right? And the evidence is using Congress to try to block this this deal with this Chinese telecom company, ZTE. Trump has given a concession back to China saying, okay, ZTE can go ahead and continue to do business in the U.S. Well, you know, the U.S. Pentagon, the military establishment, and their friends in the Senate, the Rubio and others, Corker, I believe, are carrying the water for the Pentagon here and say, no, we're going to block the ZTE deal between Trump and China. We're going to block it. Well, Trump came out and said, we're going to block your block. So there. Well, we'll see how that happens. But all that is part of this continued maneuvering going on in U.S.-China trade and the military interests in the U.S. trying to reassert themselves and prevent a deal that, you know, the big U.S. bankers and multinationals like, and even Trump may like. I think they're going to lose. I think before this thing is over, Trump and U.S. bankers are going to, quote, take the money and run. China's going to give them a big concession here on purchasing U.S. agricultural goods and allowing U.S. corporations to penetrate Chinese markets. And that's going to be enough to close the deal. And the U.S. military and intelligence agencies will come out on the short end of this. Well, anyway, that's my prediction. It may or may not be true. We'll see. But this isn't going to be resolved either until right before the elections or soon after November elections. Okay, so how about some other reports here? Gee, we're running out of time. We haven't even got to the central bank topic here. But lots of interesting things happening this past week that justify some follow-up. Well, Italy, right? I wrote about the Italian debt crisis. We got a new five-star and league plus league coalition, both populists from the left and radicals from the right, forming a new government in Italy, which looks a lot like the old Syriza government in Greece in 2015 that challenged the euro, which means challenged the ECB and challenged Germany, which controls the eurozone pretty much, through the ECB and other pan-European institutions like the European Commission and so forth, beginning to look like, is the Italian debt crisis? Well, what's that? Well, that's the price of Italian bonds escalating because of fears by investors that this new populist government in Italy may go ahead and break from the euro. Well, just as the Greek Populist Party in 2015, Syriza, said it might do, right? Well, it's got and European investors all in a tizzy here because if that even begins to happen, the euro will collapse and all their paper profits with it, right? Well, the Eurozone bankers are fighting back against the new Italian government. And as I've said in my article, also on jackrasmus.com and my blog, and my website, kiklosproductions.com, the Euro folks are, Euro bankers are fighting back by controlling the finance minister position here in Italy. Well, the finance minister, this guy Tria, has come out here this week and said, Italy won't abandon the euro. Don't worry, don't worry. Right? Italy will go ahead and reduce its debt ratio, which is 130% of GDP. Well, the only way you reduce your debt ratio, right, is to pay off some of the bonds. To do that, you got to implement a kind of austerity. As we've seen in Greece, for example, right? You make the workers in the economy pay by producing more or cutting their costs. The government cuts costs, raises pensions and so forth to get the money to pay the bankers in Northern Europe. That's what austerity really is. That's a new kind of financial imperialism I wrote about in my 2016 book, Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges. This is, state-to-state production process, above the production process, financial extraction of value. That's what the new imperialism is. Well, if they're going to go the austerity route, as the TRIA, the finance minister, says, signals, which made the bond investors happy, we'll see, because that would mean that the five-star populist movement and its right-wing ally, the League, having to be vehicles of implementing austerity, just as the Syriza government did, right? They were tamed and became the bill collector for the Troika, the Northern European German dominated pan-European institutions like ECB and European Commission, right? Syriza became the bill collector for them. And by the way, 95% of all the austerity funds extracted from Greek society went to Northern European bankers. Well, I'm not so sure that Five Star in the League and their leaders, now this guy Di Maio for Five Star and Salvini for the League, are going to go along with this, but it shows you got a split in Italian politics here, with a foothold by the Northern European bankers and this finance minister Tria, versus the popular elected folks, Di Maio and Salvini. We'll see what happens, right? Okay. At the same time, you know, Europe's economy is slowing down. Very important development going on here. IMF released a report this past week, reports that says the seven largest economies of the world, you know, mostly the European and the U.S. and Japan, grew at only 1.5% in 2017, right? And that 1.5% average across the G7, of course, was skewed up by the U.S. growth last year. So Europe is really growing far less than 1%. In fact, the GDP growth rate for the first quarter of 2018 in the Eurozone was only 0.4%. It's virtually stagnating again, right? In Germany, factory orders fell 2.5% in April. Okay, and Germany exports are declining fast, and exports are a very large part of German and European GDP. 46% of Germany's GDP comes from exports. So if exports are declining fast, well, its GDP is going to decline, which it is. Italy, 30% of its GDP is from exports. Same with France. In the U.S., in contrast, only 12% of GDP is due to export. All right. So, you know, keep an eye. We're going to keep an eye here on Europe. And that leads us to the European Central Bank's decision this past week, which was not to change anything in its QE program for at least another year. You know, QE means the central bank pumps money into the economy that buys up bonds, and all that money infusion, liquidity infusion, of course, drives down interest rates. Well, key interest rates are at zero or negative in Europe because of almost $3 trillion, 2.4 trillion euros now, has been pumped into the economy by the ECB buying up bonds. By the way, not just government bonds, but buying up corporate bonds. The problem has been that most of these bond purchases have been bonds issued by corporations and companies in economies like Germany, France, and Netherlands, and so forth, which didn't need that kind of support. The countries that needed support from the bond buying were the southern tier, you know, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, and so forth, right? And they did. The bond buying is not going there. The bond buying is going where it's not needed. And the problem further is that money pumped into the economy, purchasing corporate bonds as well as government bonds, is then flowing out of Europe, guess where? To the U.S. Why? Because U.S. interest rates are higher than Europe. The gap between European rates and U.S. rates is growing. As the U.S. raises its interest rates, now the 10-year bond at 3%, roughly, and as Europe continues pumping money in its QE to keep its interest rates down. Well, if the economy in Europe is slowing, which it is, if the ECB started retracting its free money, it would cause interest rates to rise in Europe. That would slow down the economy in Europe even more because it's very fragile, very weak, unlike the U.S. So Europe is caught between a rock and a hard place, right? If they raise interest rates by suspending their QE program now, if they raise interest rates, that would happen as a result of suspension of that program, it will slow the European economy down even more. On the other hand, you know, if they continue their QE, which they're going to do for another year, that keeps their interest rates near zero or below, while U.S. interest rates continue to rise because of the Fed decision. Okay, that gap is going to cause the money to flow out of Europe back to the U.S. All right, that's the Turn of Visions for today, June 15th.